This is BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. I'm Alex Hokule in São Paulo, Brazil, and we are also George Hoar in London. Hello.
Hey.
And Philip Cunliffe in Canterbury. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, enthusiastic. I'm going to have to compensate some compensatory enthusiasm here. Welcome. Welcome to new joiners, new subscribers. Welcome back to those of you who are rejoining us. This is the Reading Club. We're kicking it off a little bit late, but this is the beginning of the Reading Club of 2024. And we're going to talk you through what's in it in just a second, in case you haven't seen the news. Also, if you haven't seen the news, we've revamped with new regular contributors who will be joining us: Amber Lee Frost, Alex Gurevich, Lee Phillips, and Catherine Liu. We've partnered up with Damage Magazine, so we're going to have lots of Damage authors and editors on regularly. There's going to be plenty of cross-fertilization, so if that gets your juices flowing, there will be some of that. And the new Reading Club, of course. So if you've missed the news, we have updated the tiers. So if you're a current $10 subscriber, as you have been, you know, over the past year or whatever, we're going to continue giving you the Reading Club for just a little bit, but we would encourage you to upgrade, because we're going to stop servicing that tier with all the stuff that we normally do for it in short order over the course of the next month or so. So if you would kindly join us at the new tier, we would be very grateful and would love to have your presence and engagement with what we do, as always. And if you've just joined, and some of you are kind of brand new to BungaCast and have come straight into the kind of $12 tier, where we will provide you with four exclusive episodes a month plus the Reading Club, then you know, big welcome. We hope you enjoy what we do. So before I tell you what the themes in the books are, let me just tell you how this year's Reading Club will be a little bit different. We kind of have changed it up a little bit year on year. Sometimes we've done a big syllabus with lots of smaller readings. Sometimes we've just done a couple of big books, which we've read over the space of a couple of months. Now what we're going to do in 2024 is a book a month, and we're going to approach it slightly differently. We're going to rotate taking the lead on the books, and whoever is taking the lead that month will give a very detailed, exhaustive presentation of the contents of the book, so that we're all on the same page and can follow along. And then the discussions that we're going to have, we're going to try as much as possible to make them accessible and also applicable to contemporary politics. So we're not going to get too much in the weeds in the way that we did last year, where we're explaining just one book over the course of several months. So we hope that should be kind of interesting to everybody and accessible to everyone. So when, for example, if I'm not presenting and George is, I look forward to hearing George's presentation of these books in some detail and some depth. So what are the books going to be? We have three themes to start off the year: Russia, past and present; the rise and fall of nations; and then the intelligentsia and the public. So just to let you know what the books are, we have Imagined Communities by Benedict Anderson from 1983. That's going to be today. Next month, we are going to have A New Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere and Deliberative Politics by Jürgen Habermas. You might recognize that title. This is Jürgen Habermas coming back and updating, re-upping, presenting a new interpretation of his old argument about the public sphere in 2023, which is when the book was published. We also have on Russia, Stalin, A Political Biography by the great Isaac Deutscher from 1949. Stalin's General by Jeffrey Roberts, which is a more recent book from 2013. Imitation Democracy by Dmitry Furman from 2010. And then finally, Julien Banda's The Treason of the Intellectuals, back from 1927. So you'll see there, it's a mix both of themes, of topics, as well as dates of publication. A lot of these authors are no longer with us, even if they may have been with us in spirit avant la lettre. I don't know what I'm going for there. But anyway, I'm going to pass over to George before
French,
I stop talking more.
A French rhetorical flourish.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway.
Very nice. Yes. So kicking off this 2024 syllabus, we have, and people who are watching this on video can see me holding up a copy. We have Benedict Anderson's Imagine Communities, Reflections on the Origin and Spread of Nationalism. And Phil is also holding up a copy there as well. Yes, this is a Verso book from 1983. Get into some of the reception of the book and its enormous popularity and enduring influence. But just a bit of biographical detail on Anderson to kick things off. So he was born in August 1936 in Kunming in southwest China. And this was just before Japan invaded the north of China. And, you know, similar or almost a contemporary of J.G. Ballard, whose work we've discussed on this podcast before, who was born in Shanghai in 1936. And anyone who's read Empire of the Sun, there's lots of good stuff there. I think Ballard's experience a bit more spicy than Anderson's, one way to put it.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, we have done Ballard on this podcast quite a lot, and a very interesting figure in his own right, so I shouldn't minimize that. But yeah, so the Anderson family, a rich Anglo-Irish family. Anderson's father was a senior official in the Chinese Maritime Custom Office, and Anderson family, painting a bit of a picture here, in 1941, went to leave China to head back to Ireland, but got stuck in the USA till 1945. Upon returning to the UK, Anderson, along with his brother, and more on him later, went to Eton, and then Benedict went off to Cambridge to study classics. And then he moves to Cornell as a teaching assistant, specializing in kind of political science, specifically with a focus on Indonesia. And I think one of the, we'll kind of come to why I think some of this is important in a sec, but one of the, important events in his kind of early life then was him and his colleagues writing this, well, not all that confidential, it turns out, analysis of General Suharto's 1965 coup, which, when the Indonesian authorities found out about, he got banned from going to Indonesia except for one unsanctioned visit in 1972. And so he was then a Indonesian expert, but not able to go to the country until Suharto fell from power in 1998. And Anderson himself died in Java in 2015. So what's the context of, you know, writing this book? The first thing, until its publication in 1983, Anderson was known as a specialist in Southeast Asian studies, specifically Indonesia, you know, very, you know, or would have definitely been marked by his experience of the Vietnam War and the wars between the socialist states of Vietnam, China, and Cambodia. But also, on the other hand, involved in, at the time, the arguments in Britain around, particularly amongst Marxists around the New Left Review, around kind of Tom Nairn's and Benedict's brother Perry Anderson's theses on the development of the British state and British history, and Nairn's book in 1978, The Breakup of Britain. So just a bit of context there, this kind of debate between Nairn on the one hand, or Nairn and Anderson on the one hand, and Erics Hobsbawm and others on the other hand. And Hobsbawm kind of came in quite, you know, punching, with some quite harsh criticisms of Nairn's 78 book, saying that you basically can't be a Marxist and a nationalist. This might seem like quite, I don't know, in the mists of time sort of arguments, but this clearly influenced the line that Anderson develops in Imagine Communities. And just in doing my researches for this show, I found out something that I didn't know before, which was the anthropologist Clifford Geertz was also an Indonesianist like Benedict Anderson, and his Interpretation of Cultures, which is a collection from 1973, which is very good. Where he advocates for thick description. This is what he talks about. You have to kind of, when describing a culture, provide the kind of cultural context, not just kind of an analytical description of practices. You know, this might sound like not that connected, but I think one of the kind of analyses of Anderson's work is that he's essentially anthropological when he discusses what nationalism is, and we'll come back to that in a bit. Yeah, finally, as I mentioned,
lots of Indonesia chat. So we should probably give a shout out to our recent episodes on Indonesia that we've done.
We should.
The biggest country no one talks about. So that came out in February. If you're a new joiner, check those out.
Except we talk about it.
Except we do.
Yeah, it's not accidental also that it's kind of a... I remember, like Hobsbawm said, his kind of mental laboratory, I think he says it in Interesting Times, his memoir, his mental laboratory was Latin America. In a sense, and that it kind of the way in which it played out certain kind of themes of political and social modernity in an entirely different context from Europe allowed you to observe those phenomena, nationalism, war of the state, different kind of political options, socialism, liberalism, and so on, to play how they give you different kind of perspective on them from the kind of the modern European trajectory. And I suppose it's not accidental that you have a different kind of, you know, Indonesia is a laboratory for a different strain of analysis in the 20th century, you know, given its enormous scale, its enormous population, its diversity is in terms of religion, language, and what have you, as well as its, you know, being at the kind of confluence of all of these competing imperial projects in the 20th century as well.
No, I think that's a really good point. Personally, I think if I have a mental laboratory, it's probably more focused on England and or Western Europe. So it's more of a kind of closer to home laboratory than Indonesia, for me at least. But yeah, so...
Where's Alex's mental laboratory? I'm just curious.
Latin America.
Is it Latin America?
Yeah, Brazilianist.
Brazil, yeah, I mean, Brazil.
You live and work there, so...
Right. But I mean, you know, I think it's like as a sort of, I think kind of the modal experience of humanity is probably the kind of Brazilian experience is closer to that than it would be in Western Europe, certainly, or it would be in, like, let's say, like the poorest countries of Africa, which are, you know, to kind of take two extremes. So anyway, we can talk about periphery and kind of how you analyze politics and whatever at a different time.
Alex is the modal man of humanity then. That's good to establish.
They're not average. Modal.
Exactly.
No, you didn't say that.
The modal guy.
You represent the mode of humanity. Humanity's modus operandi, perhaps.
That's,
anyhow,
that's why we're fucked.
So just to wrap up this kind of very brief biographical sketch of Benedict Anderson, brother of Perry Anderson, as I mentioned before, this, you know, longtime driving force behind New Left Review and a collaborator with Tom Nairn on these Nairn Anderson theses. So, you know, very much involved in, as I said, these debates between Marxists over whether you can be a Marxist or a nationalist. A bit more complicated than that, but that's essentially the George's gist of it, you might say. The incredible popularity of the book is something I did want to comment on, because I did, again, some researches. I checked Google Scholar this afternoon, and it said that it had 143,300
citations.
That's serious
research. You checked on Google Scholar. That's like real preparation. I mean, there.
Yeah, this I could be
you a... You taught some serious research skills there.
I could be a contemporary undergraduate or maybe graduate student with my one venture to Google Scholar. But no, that's, I mean, it's astonishing. Verso claimed that it's cited more often than any other single English language work in human sciences. It's been translated into more than 30 languages. And it's gone through three different editions. So, you know, not to get too into the weeds of like the different chapters added on, but I think it's kind of interesting. So the first edition, 1983, second edition, 1991. This adds two new chapters, one on census map museum, which is on censuses, maps, and museums, and one on memory and forgetting, which is a bit harder to summarize, but maybe with a bit of poetic license. It's on how nations write their own biographies. Third edition, I mean, it's almost a whole career that he's, I mean, not to minimize his other work, but I would imagine most listeners know Benedict Anderson. Imagine Communities, that is the link that they would make, and certainly the one that I do in my head. So third edition, 2006, adds an afterword, Travel and Traffic, on the geobiography of Imagined Communities, which is on the legacy of the book and how it's been translated and mistranslated, or translation as a useful treason. There's all these kind of ideas in there in a number of different languages. I don't think he covers the full 30, but a few of those. And I also read or heard somewhere, and I can't remember where, haven't got a citation for this, came to me in a dream or whatever, that half of Verso's profits come from the royalties of this book still today. So yeah, something ridiculous like that. I might be wrong on that. But yeah, I mean, I guess in short, it's not a text. It's a kind of mini cultural academic phenomenon, for want of a better phrase. And Anderson himself, I think, you know, judging by his remarks in that 1991 introduction, that 2006 afterword, was quite surprised by how much of life the book took on of its own. And he said in a 2005 interview of the book, apparently, that it was like a daughter who has grown up and run away with a bus driver. I see her occasionally, but really she has gone on her own merry way. I can wish her good luck, but now she belongs with someone else. So maybe we're some of the people with whom this book now belongs.
I take exception to Benedict referring to our listeners as bus drivers.
I think he's saying
that there's anything wrong with driving a bus, but there seems to be a condescension in his tone, I should say.
Well, maybe it's like the bus driver can take the daughter.
He can drive her off.
He's got his own means of, I mean, he actually doesn't own his own means of transport. Maybe it's like a self-employed bus driver who owns the bus and can take the daughter wherever they agree to go together. But yes, thanks for pointing that out, Phil.
Not many holidays, though, where they're driving off somewhere, because that would be a busman's holiday, and those are to be avoided, I think.
But if you like your job every day as a busman's holiday, anyhow, maybe to get onto the reception or the, I don't know, this, I guess this is a book, you know, I've laid it out how just like it's how ubiquitous it is. But it also has a reputation as a bit of a like an undergraduate book, you know, first year undergraduate in politics or sociology or whatever, that you get assigned and you read five pages of. Is that fair? Do you guys, when you sort of see this book, do you have these vague memories of feeling guilty for not having read something that you were supposed to?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I know Alex, back when he was an LSE twink, had Nations and Nationalism as part of his course. I have to say, so look, going back to this was it was interesting on all sorts of different scores. So I remember a few distinct things, actually. So it was only, I think it was only the first chapter that was assigned on the reading list that I did as an undergraduate. And I remember finding it very frustrating to read at the time because it didn't, you know, precisely because it has this kind of essayistic kind of structure, it didn't conform to the reading that I needed to do in order to write the essay on Nations and Nationalism for that week, back in the day when, you know, Oxford students were actually expected to write more than one essay a week. And so that was kind of frustrating, the kind of the thoughtful kind of layering of insights and observations as the discussion progresses. But the thing that really blew my mind was that this was in the context of discussions. So this was when this was the early 2000s, and so it was in the context of discussions mainly about, you know, places, Nations and Nationalism was in the context of discussions mainly about places like Rwanda and the Balkans. And so it was kind of the thing that remained with me the most and I couldn't quite process at the time was everything else on the reading list was kind of about I don't know, kind of, you know, liberal strategies for managing ethnic conflicts on the periphery in the era of kind of unipolarity, you know. And so reading the book and then opening it up and seeing how he talks about how he was motivated to write it by his deep, you know, by his disenchantment with the Khmer Rouge on fighting the Vietnamese, basically. I just couldn't, there was no way I could fit that in to you know, my understanding of what kind of social science was supposed to be, right? Because everybody else was kind of a serious liberal with a policy program that would have, you know, kind of gone down well at some kind of think tank seminar or something. And then you have this guy here saying he was shocked when the Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge went at it. When obviously, you know, from my point of view as a kind of undergraduate in the peak period of globalization, how anyone could ever have been vested in the Vietnamese and Cambodian communist projects and have kind of hopes that they would have, that would have ended up being like a positive or optimistic scenario, you know, that kind of, I just couldn't I couldn't understand it. It totally, I don't want to say it blew my mind, because it didn't. It didn't make me reconsider those things, you know, but it did kind of, I suppose it did give an insight into some of the insane byways, I suppose, of 20th century Marxism in a way that I hadn't really appreciated from my other encounters with Marxism that far in my academic studies.
Yeah, no, I think it does have that strange quality. Alex, have you read it?
I've read it certainly twice. Well, I'm not going to say more than twice, but I've read it twice. Annoyingly, I probably don't remember as much of it as I would have wanted until I kind of started looking back at it a little bit before this. That was an area which I was interested in, kind of nations and nationalism. So I did it both at undergrad and master's level, until a friend of mine was like, well, you know, maybe you don't want to specialize in this. That's kind of old hat. You know, this isn't really the time of nations and nationalism. It's on decline. Philip Cunliffe was the person who said that. And I regret and I resent him for that, because actually it would have been a good thing to specialize on it, because it's kind of a lot more relevant now than it was in 2007 when he told me that.
Have you got like you've got a
you ruined my future, man.
Recorded say.
Yeah, it's good to keep.
I'm trying to get you off the scent of Brexit, because obviously I wanted that for myself. Right, so.
You didn't even know the name of Brexit. You couldn't have.
Good to keep a list of grievances against friends, you know.
Yeah, like an ancient ethnic feud that's totally confected by the intelligentsia at a later point, indeed.
Right. Well, good foreshadowing there. But the only thing I will say about it at this stage, because George is still going to kind of introduce what's in the book, not just about the book, but I found it, reading it alongside various other theories of nationalism, and we're going to come on to maybe gesture a little bit of what those are, just to kind of put it, maybe it's a bit into its intellectual context. And it's worth saying another thing, that the 1980s was the period of the birth of kind of this modern study of nationalism. It's quite late, right? You think like, well, really? 1980s? Surely people were talking about it in the 1920s and the 30s and maybe even earlier than that. No. As an academic area of study, it really was in the 1980s that it was birthed. Funnily enough, kind of at a fairly late stage, and when after the kind of anti-colonial revolts and the founding of new nations in Africa and Asia, that was kind of already at its tail end as people were writing that. Of course, there was another revival in the Age of Nations, a new springtime of nations, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the ethnic wars that Phil has already mentioned. But I find it quite late. But anyway, so there's all these theories going on. And what I found interesting about Anderson's book, though it kind of puzzled me, is that unlike a book like, which I'm going to hold up here for people who read this, Nations and Nationalism Since 1780, Program, Myth, Reality by Eric Hobsbawm, like the Anderson's book, it like comes at the question very tangentially in various things. So he's talking a lot about newspapers, and he's talking about Creole intellectuals. And I remember as an undergrad thinking, what the hell is that about? I mean, that's maybe interesting, but I need to write this essay. I want an answer to like where nations come from. And he's talking about this stuff, which seems kind of peripheral, an add-on, a bit of color rather than the meat of the thing. So anyway, but that's what makes it, I think, such a popular book, because you can take all these different things from it, even if the question you're seeking to answer is not necessarily what is the origin of nations, but it might be about something else. So anyway, I'll let George take it.
No, I think that's a point to particularly for listeners who haven't read the book. I think it is a point to make, and I've got a couple of quotes that hopefully kind of illustrate this a little for those who haven't had a chance to read this. I think that's a very good point, Alex, on like why is it so late that the that nationalism studies kind of come about. You know, what is it that philosopher said about the owl of Minerva getting flying late in the day or something, you know, one of those kind of situations perhaps. But in terms of what I think it would be good for us to cover in the book, there's a recent article by David Polansky in Foreign Policy that claims, and this I think follows on from what you're both saying a little bit, that imagined communities is far weirder than you remember. And I think he's right. So, you know, you might be able to gauge this from our discussion, but for listeners that haven't, as I said, haven't read this, the subtitle is Reflections on the Origin and Spread of Nationalism. But it isn't one of these like chapter one definition, chapter two this period of history, chapter three that period of history, implications, policy program, prospects. It's much more evasive, and you know, he discusses, as you know, the two of you already alluded to a certain extent, novels, newspapers, books, ontology a little bit, some anthropology thrown in there, as I said. He concludes the original edition with a short chapter on Benjamin's analysis of the Paul Klee painting, New Angel. He jumps around geography and history. He makes claims like, and this is a quote, "No more arresting emblems of the modern culture of nationalism exist than cenotaphs and tombs of unknown soldiers. The public ceremonial reverence accorded these monuments precisely because they are either deliberately empty or no one knows who lies inside them has no true precedent in earlier times." And that's one of those things where you're like, that's really interesting.
Yeah. I remember that did stay with me.
Yeah. Hi there, friends. This is the end of a sample from an episode available only to subscribers at patreon.com/bungacast. For $7 a month, subscribers get at least 4 original exclusive episodes a month, featuring Alex, George, and Phil, as well as our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Amberly Frost, Catherine New, and Lee Phillips. We've got episodes on current affairs, extended interviews, exclusive episodes on theory, history, culture, docuseries, analyses of film, and our responses to listeners' questions and criticisms. And for $12 a month, you also get access to the very special BungaCast Reading Club, where we present the key books and essays necessary for understanding the world today, how we got here, and where we might be going. Of course, if you just want to try us out, there's also a $3 entry tier giving you one exclusive episode a month. We do hope you'll join us. These are turbulent times, and ideologically confused ones as well. We try to find some political clarity so that we might move beyond the age of bunga bunga.